You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
On Saturday afternoon, gay supporters of Donald Trump and the organizers are right not to use LGBTQALFTSQNBIA supporters of Donald Trump since sexual minorities for Trump seems to be an exclusively gay white male head trauma. On Saturday afternoon, gay supporters of Donald Trump gathered on the mall in view of the White House and they rallied, all 10 of them. If you haven't seen the pictures, if the news about this hilariously empty rally was crowded out of your timeline by the president's latest bullying sexist tweet storm, oh man, the pics are worth looking up. There's a really good one at thenewcivilrightsmovement.com, and man, is that picture mortifying. Mortifying in two ways. First, it has to be mortifying for the organizers, who must have been embarrassed by the non-turnout. Although it remains an open question whether politically clueless assholes who are incapable of feeling shame are somehow capable of feeling mortified or embarrassed. And secondly, the pics are mortifying to the vast and overwhelming majority of other queers in this country, the LGBTQALFTSQNBIA community, who reject these flaming ass hats and their red MAGA hats. The organizers of the event, they were mortified for a moment, for as long as their pathetic little rally lasted. The rest of us, however, the overwhelming majority of queers, we are constantly mortified by these people because we are asked by straight people again and again and again to explain the existence of gays for Trump, all 10 of them. How'd that happen? Where are they coming from? Where do they get off? Well, they get off on the coverage they get, more coverage in the media and on political blogs than they should get out of all proportion to their numbers. And every time they make the news, even if all they've done is hold a rally that literally no one attended, we are asked to explain them again. I've unpacked it before. It's been a while, but I'm getting questions in the wake of the Gays for Trump rally in D.C. So once more, with feeling gay people abuse drugs, alcohol, and tobacco at higher rates than straight people do. We also commit suicide at higher rates. Now, haters on the right argue this proves the gay lifestyle is dangerous and unhealthy because being gay makes us do all these things. Like so much else, the haters have this backwards. Being gay doesn't make us do these things. Being gay doesn't damage us. It's the way we're treated for being gay. The discrimination, oppression, bigotry, rejection by family members poisoned by their faiths, that leaves many of us damaged, and this damage can manifest itself in self-destructive behaviors. Watching a gay friend drink himself to death or drug himself to death or fuck himself to death or all three at once himself to death, it isn't pretty. And it's often hard to be or remain friends with someone who is intent on destroying himself in these ways because they're not satisfied destroying themselves only. They have to destroy other gay men too. Using meth isn't enough. They want their friends to use meth with them. Abusing alcohol isn't enough. They want their friends to match them drink for drink. And spinning out of control sexually, it isn't enough. All other friends have to be cum dumps too. Anyway, if you want to know why a gay man would rally for Trump with 9 of his closest friends, Trump, who is undermining the rights of LGBT Americans with each appointment he makes, the Supreme Court is poised to turn the clock back decades, and that's with just one Trump appointment so far. If you want to know what's up with them, look to the meth addicts and the drunks. While most self-loathing, self-destructive gay men are content to abuse drugs or alcohol or dick, some gay men abuse themselves with politics. Like those meth addicts who aren't satisfied harming only themselves, gays for Trump, like log cabin Republicans and go proud assholes before them, aren't satisfied harming themselves only. They want to harm other gay people too. They want to harm all gay people everywhere by supporting a party and a politician intent on harming them. Gays for Trump, again, all 10 of them, went to that rally for the same reason your meth addicted pal keeps picking up that pipe. Because they're damaged. All right, coming up on today's show, tons of your Q, lots of my A. And on the Magnum edition of the Savage Lovecast, which you can subscribe to at www.savagelovecast.com, a longer show and no ads. We have special guest Mistress Matisse joining us for the Magnum to talk about Velvet Swing, her new line of THC-enhanced lubricants. That's in the Magnum, along with more questions, more Q, more my A, in the Magnum, savagelovecast.com. Today's episode is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers all fresh, high-quality ingredients and recipes you need to create delicious home-cooked meals. Get your first three meals for free by going to blueapron.com/savage. Thanks to Audible for supporting the Savage Lovecast. For a free 30-day trial, go to audible.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. A 27-year-old gay kinky male here. I think this might be a first for your show. Not sure. This might be a question for the audience, though. I recently enlisted in the Marines, and my kink is being locked long-term in chastity. This only poses a problem because in the military, we are randomly piss tests, and these tests are conducted in a way that you have to expose yourself to the person administering the test. I have a non-combat job, so I'll mostly be at a desk making this, in theory, doable, except for these tests. I'm sure I don't have to go into how close-minded the military is. So my question is, do you or your audience have any experience with this? Is there any way that I can stay locked, or do I have to give this up while serving? Thank you.
The UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, doesn't cover long-term male chastity play. And I would call the Defense Department and try to get a ruling, but I can't imagine I would get, first of all, an answer, because the Trump administration hasn't staffed up the Pentagon or the State Department or anything else. But I can't imagine I would get a positive response or even a hearing. I would probably get a phone slammed down. So I don't have an answer for you. Maybe there's a listener out there who does, a former JAG maybe listener might have an answer for you, but it seems like the sort of thing you would have to take up with your superiors. People are allowed to have kinks, but your kink includes hardware that's not a part of your uniform. So I have no fucking idea. Now, of course, wearing a male chastity device, you can still piss. You can still drop trousers in front of somebody. You can fill the jar that the person administering the piss test needs filled. They can see the urine is coming out of your dick, even if your dick is locked up in a male chastity device. So it isn't going to prevent the test from being administered. And maybe the person administering the test, therefore, won't have a problem with it. But like the good, fine, hardworking people at TSA, they'll probably be taken aback by your male chastity device when they spot it on you. When you drop trousers for your piss test in the Marines, when they see it in the x-ray at TSA, at the airport, at security, and it'll probably kick off a whole conversation. So I don't have an answer for you. I don't think I can get an answer for you. Maybe a listener out there has an answer for you. But the person, I think, who's likeliest to have an answer for you and you're likeliest to get an immediate response from is the person who is lucky enough to be administering that piss test to all the hot, kinky, gay Marines out there.
Hi, Dan, Nancy, and the Tech Savvy At-Risk Youth. I'm a 26-year-old woman from Canada. So I've been sleeping with one of my best friends for about 3 months now. The sex is really, really good, and we get along incredibly well. The problem is he's engaged to be married in about 4 months. So for context, he and his partner have been together for a pretty long time, about 8 or 9 years, and they aren't in an open relationship. So from what I understand, their relationship has had quite a few problems, although according to him, this is the first time he's ever cheated on her or anyone at all. So I guess my question is, well, I'm in this position where I'm his friend, and I'm also the only person who knows he's cheating on his fiance. So should I be the one who talks to him about whether or not he should be making a marriage-level commitment? It's not that I want him to leave his fiancée to be with me or anything, necessarily. I'm just more concerned about seeing a friend make a decision he'll regret. But at the same time, I'm worried that having this conversation will mean losing him as a friend and, to be completely honest, as a fuck buddy. So what should I do, if anything?
There are so many different and conflicting roles that you are playing in the life of this man. You are best friend. You are fuck buddy. You are probably invited to the wedding that I think you should probably recuse yourself because your conflicts of interests are legion. But if he is your best friend and he's fucking you, you should have this conversation with him about what the fuck is he doing? He's marrying someone else in 3 months. And also, what the fuck are you doing? He's marrying someone else in 3 months. And he's fucking you, his best friend. Does he not want to marry this woman? Is he slamming his hand down on the eject / self-destruct button? Does he not want to make a monogamous commitment? And clearly, it seems he doesn't. Those are conversations he needs to have with his fiance before he marries her. And he's honor bound to have those. Honor bound. I don't think honor comes into it at this juncture, but he's obligated, morally obligated. I don't think morals come into it at this juncture either. He's obligated to have this conversation with her before the wedding, because the odds that this will come out after the wedding are really high. You know, people sometimes do this. They think, oh, I'm going to get married, so I'm going to do these things that I really want to do before I get married, because then when I'm married, these things stop. And you know what? They don't stop when you get married. If he's going to fuck other women, when he's engaged to someone else and a monogamous commitment, hopefully an explicit one, not just a default setting monogamous commitment exists, he's going to continue to do those things after the wedding. I think you should use whatever standing you have with him as his fuck buddy and his best friend to encourage him to be honest with his fiance about who he is, what he's capable of, what he's incapable of, obviously honoring a monogamous commitment, not capable of that, and what he wants going forward. Because it would be a mistake for him to marry this woman under these circumstances, under false pretenses about who he is and what he wants and what he's capable of. And you're not the ideal messenger as best friend and fuck buddy and invitee to the wedding. And you do have a massive conflict of interest here. And you say that you don't really want him for yourself, but you don't really want to lose him as a fuck buddy either, which makes me doubt that you are being honest when you say you don't really want him for yourself. You do want him at least as a fuck buddy for yourself. And you're likely actually to continue to have him as a fuck buddy for yourself, even if he gets married, because I don't think if you would fuck this guy 3 months before his wedding, you're going to stop fucking him after his wedding. And I don't think if he would fuck you 3 months before his wedding, he's going to stop fucking you after his wedding either. Seems to me that the person he should be thinking about marrying is you, because you two deserve each other. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. They make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, including people like me. I was hopeless. I still am a little hopeless in the kitchen, but I can follow Blue Apron's step-by-step instructions and prepare delicious and nutritious meals all by my lonesome. I am cooking more and more now these days, thanks to Blue Apron. Blue Apron supports a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients and building a community of home chefs. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-proportioned ingredients to help you make delicious home-cooked meals. Choose from a variety of new recipes each week or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you will never get bored. You can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Blue Apron has several delivery options, so you can choose what fits your needs, and there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Here are a couple of items on the menu coming up. Seared chicken and creamy pasta salad with summer squash and sweet peppers. Creamy shrimp rolls with quick pickles and sweet potato wedges. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/savage. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Try out Blue Apron and support the Savage Lovecast by going to blueapron.com/savage. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Hey, Dan. So I've been dating this woman for over a year, and 95% of the time she is fantastic. She is smart, and she's funny, and she's beautiful, and I really treasure our relationship, but the other 5% of the time, she can get upset and she gets angry and she loses her mind. And I don't mean that in a bitch be crazy kind of way. I mean, like, she gets drunk and she says hurtful things. She can get violent, and it's not okay. So I have gone through counseling myself. I know that she has abandonment issues. I know she has other issues, and she has talked about them with me and has said that she's gone through counseling before and that she doesn't want to do it anymore because it's difficult. And I've told her about my counseling times and tried to let her know that it's not a stigma, that there's no judgment, that that can be helpful. But she's not really interested. The thing that I keep going back to is that if my sister or a female friend of mine came to me and said, I am dating this person and they are acting this way and sometimes they're violent and da-da-da-da-da, then I would tell them to run. And it seems different because she's small and I'm big and it's not usually a problem and most days it's great, but it doesn't feel great. And I know you can't ultimatum somebody into seeking counseling. I know that you can't force someone to try and work on themselves, that that's something they have to do for themselves. But I'm reaching 40 and I want a family and I'm getting older and I don't know what to do about when it's too much, when you can't accept it anymore and say, I don't want this to be my life and I don't want this to be the life of my kids. I feel like I'm making it sound more dramatic than it usually is, but sometimes it's kind of dramatic.
You've only been with this person for a year and it's awful 5% of the time. Talk to anyone who is in a long, long, long-term relationship with someone who is abusive. And often what you'll hear them say was, you know, at first it was great most of the time, 90, 95% of the time. He was lovely. It was awesome. It was great. And then 5% of the time it was terrible. He would get drunk. He would get violent, abusive, or she would get drunk. She would get violent. She would get abusive. And I stayed because it was just that 5%, because the 95% of the time that was so great was worth sort of plowing through that 5%. But here's the thing, that percentage grows over time. The longer you're there, the bigger the percentage of that is awful gets. You'll go from 95% wonderful and 5% of the time awful to 10% of the time awful and 90% of the time to 80% or 70% of the time wonderful and 30% of the time awful. And eventually it's flipped. Eventually it's 95% of the time awful and you're walking on eggshells all the time and this person is always blowing up at you randomly and you are married and you have children and getting the fuck out, getting away from this person is a lot harder, and that's what the abuser counts on. They police themselves for their abusive shit and keep a lid on it as best they can long enough to get you to a point where you can't escape or they don't think you can escape or the costs of escape are so great that you may continue to hesitate and they can keep ramping the abusive shit the fuck up. I don't know if this is conscious on the part of abusers or subconscious, but it is common. And I can see it coming. It is coming for you. You need to get the fuck away from this person. You shouldn't be contemplating having children with this person. The rage and the physical violence that she subjects you to when you are drunk, she will subject your children, her children, to that same rage, to that same violence when she is drunk. And having kids is hard and it is stressful. And it can bring out the best in some of us. It can bring out the worst in some of us. It brings out the best and worst of us at different times and different measures. It's good to have a partner there so that when the pressures of parenting you can feel bringing out the worst in you, you can step back and your partner can take over and you can relay race that shit a little bit. But you do not want to subject children. You don't want to bring children to home with someone that you know to be an abuser. And she is an abuser. Now, you can go to her and say, I have heard you say that getting into counseling was hard and unpleasant and that you don't want to go back there, but it can be helpful. And as of now, it's not just potentially a help, it is a condition of my continuing to see you. And this is a hallelujah pass where you say, if you want, we've been together a year, if you want to continue to date me, therapy and counseling for you because of this 5%. And because of the likelihood that 5% will grow over time, the longer I stick around, you need to get to work on that with a counselor as a condition of our continuing to see each other. And if she will not, because it's hard, because being in counseling is hard, well, being in a relationship with her in this condition, that's hard too. And you have the option of going. And I would encourage you to go. But if you want to stay because you want family, because you want kids, and she might be the one that you want to have them with, if you want to invest a little more time in her, all right then, but she has to be in counseling. She has to be in therapy. She has to be working on her rage and anger and alcohol issues. And if she won't work on those things, then you really fucking have to go. You have to end this relationship. You've only invested a year. You're only 40. 40 is the new 22 or whatever the fuck. You can find someone else. You can get the fuck out. You can find someone who's not a ticking rage violence bomb. Just add alcohol. Audible has an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original shows, news, comedy, and more. Audiobooks are great to listen to when you're driving, on the subway or bus, doing chores around the house, or at the gym. For our listeners, Audible is offering a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/savage. Please be sure to go to audible.com/savage and browse their unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title for free and start listening. It's that easy. One audiobook to consider is Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus by Laura Kipnis, feminist cultural critic and NU professor, also the author of Against Love, a hilarious polemic, and Men, Notes from an Ongoing Investigation, all also available at Audible. But you're going to want to read or have read to you Unwanted Advances by Laura Kipnis. And you can download that title for free by going to audible.com/savage. Once again, for that 30-day free trial, go to audible.com/savage. That's audible.com/savage.
Hey, Dan. I'm from New York. I'm a single male. I just had a very basic question for you. I've noticed with my guy friends, a number of us are into feet, which is, you know, there's a little bit of a stigma around that. And I've wondered before, what is the reason behind that? You know, with breasts, you could somehow add logic to that and say that it has to do with breastfeeding. Why do you think it is that so many, if not all, of my male friends are either a little bit into feet or a lot into feet, however you want to put it? Why do you think that is? I'm just kind of curious if you had any thoughts on this. Very basic question.
I don't think your question is basic at all. I think your question is fascinating, but the question isn't why are some men into feet. The question is why are all your male friends into feet? You're the common denominator in this foot fetishist equation. I know a lot of guys. I have a lot of male friends, and I've known a couple of foot fetishist friends, but they were outliers. It was rare. They were one of very few of my male friends who were into feet, had this particular relatively common fetish, but common in the fetish sense means like 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 100. That all of your friends are into feet? That baffles me. Unless foot fetishism is contagious, literally contagious. It's a bacteria. It can be spread through the air. You can catch it because a foot fetishist sneezes on you at work. Nothing can explain this mystery. Nothing can unpack this mystery. Not all men are into feet. Foot fetishism, fetishism is kind of a constant, a set percentage, and new things come along and can be processed through our erratic imaginations and wind up being kinked. Latex clothing, for instance, didn't exist before the Second World War, and now there's a whole latex fetish clothing industry and thing, and that came along and it was new. But feet are old. Feet have been around probably for as long as we've been around, and the numbers of people who fetishize them aren't going to grow, not a new thing. So I can't answer this question. I have no idea why it is that all of your male friends are into feet. The only thing that could possibly explain it is coincidence or bullshitting. But you sounded sincere, so I suspect it's not bullshitting. My money's on coincidence.
Hey, Dan. I'm a 15-year-old heterosexual male, and I have a question about this girl. We're definitely interested in each other, but she doesn't want a date yet because she just got out of a long-term relationship, which, you know, I understand. That's, she doesn't want to jump right into anything. But what I don't understand is she always gets really, she gets really jealous when she doesn't really have the grounds to be jealous. When she first broke up with her boyfriend, she went out to lunch and still hung out with him, which went just fine. You know, I mentioned it later, though. I said, you know, I guess we're not dating, so I can't say anything about it, really. But I don't really like that you're going and having lunch with this guy. And she said, well, we're not really dating, so it's none of your business, which I respected, and I bought it out. Didn't worry about it. But then later, I have a friend who's a female who I was just a friend, nothing more. And I've been very clear to her that she is just a friend. And when I told her about it and that we were going to be hanging out, she got really, like, she got really jealous and she got really distant and didn't want to talk and was very upset. And I don't really know what to think, you know. So my question is, what do I say? Because I don't want to upset her, but I also want to be able to hang out with my friends and not be limited to only male friends.
Want to emphasize, want to highlight the fact for callers who may have been half paying attention that your 15 years old caller is 15 years old. This is high school drama. You get upset when she hangs out or goes out with guys until she reassures you that it is not a date. She gets upset when you see girls until you reassure her. Well, it doesn't work when you reassure her. She still gets upset whether or not you tell her it's a date or not. You two need to stay the fuck away from each other. You two either need to date and then be able to regulate who each other spends time with, which is a fool's errand, but very common for teenagers and hopefully something you'll get over in short order. Or you need to not date. And if you're not dating, then you don't answer to each other. She can hang out and be with and see and even date whoever she wants. And so can you. Period. End of discussion. You don't answer to her. She doesn't answer to you. You are not each other's boyfriend or girlfriend. You are merely friends. And if being friends is this complicated, if it creates this much drama in your lives and this much anger and jealousy, you shouldn't even be friends.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 31-year-old gay guy in the West Coast. My partner of 7 years passed away suddenly last year. And since then, I've been grieving and also going to therapy. But I'm at a point now where I want to start dating again. I don't know. I feel so young to be a widower stage of my life that I find it hard to relate with anyone. I mean, especially guys to talk to on Grindr and other dating apps. But having said that, I turn to porn and also message a lot of guys on apps for either just chat or meetups. I usually message a few new guys at every day, and we'll either try to set up a date or just trade naked pictures. I don't know. I've only hooked up twice since my partner's passing. I feel like I'm young and in shape, and I feel like I'm too young to be wearing a black veil, but I also don't know if it's healthy for me to basically be obsessed with Grindr, Scruff, Tinder, etc. My therapist is sex positive and gay friendly, but I haven't brought this up to him because I want your input first. I don't know what it means to be a young gay widower with a high desire for sex, naked pictures, sexting, attention, whatever. I also don't know if guys find me too hard to unpack once they find out about my partner's passing. I usually get, "I'm so sorry, I can't imagine" response from them. I guess it just boils down to me being lonely, horny, and afraid of how new guys I date will react to me best. I also just don't know how to be a 31-year-old gay widower and be out there again.
You say you don't know how to be a 31-year-old gay widower, but you don't have to know how to do that because you are that.
Right.
And whatever you're doing is right. What a 31-year-old gay widower would do. And my heart goes out to you, and I'm really sorry. That said, if you feel that being on the apps is compulsive, if you feel that it's not bringing joy to you at a time where you may need to re-experience joy, then it's a problem. But if you're just slut-shaming yourself or sex-shaming yourself or desire-shaming yourself in the wake of your partner's death, and again, my heart breaks for you, you need to not do that. You are still alive, and you have desire and needs and that's good. You know, those impulses to still reach out, to still want is what will carry you through this time. It's not disrespectful to your partner or his memory or your relationship to still want and still experience.
Right. And I think I have gone through a couple of times in the last, I would say, 6-7 months where I did put those apps down, and I can go on them for about a week, and that felt okay. I think it was more just, like you said, just desire shaming myself, and I didn't know exactly how to process it, and I'm still in the grieving process, which I accept I'm going to be in that process for a while.
You know what?
Whatever.
You're going to be in that process forever. That kind of loss... Yeah. And I'm not comparing the two, because the loss of a parent is to be expected. I forget who first said it, but you know, to lose a parent is to lose your past, to lose a child is to lose your future, and to lose a partner, to lose your spouse, is to lose your present.
Right.
And I don't think that's a loss you ever fully recover from, nor should you feel obligated to. But also, you know, when you acknowledge that this is a loss you'll never fully recover from, some people feel like it's disrespectful to the memory of their partner if they can move through a day or a week appearing to be recovered from it, or feeling recovered from it, or, you know, feeling sort of functional and fully reengaged with life. And
right. And
that's not a betrayal of your partner or his memory to be fully reengaged with life and love and lust and desire and sex. It's not. And what I began to say, what I'm not comparing, is when I lost my mother, which is an expected loss and a natural one, it took me a while to kick back into gear. And then when I did, I felt like, how can I be having sex in a world where my mother no longer exists, where I've lost my mother? How can I prioritize this or feel good about this? And I don't think that's a fully rational response. And in my experience, it just, that feeling dissipated, that those weren't irreconcilable, to live with the loss of my mother, but also live with desire. That I didn't have to choose one.
Right.
That they existed concurrently. Yeah. That sense of loss and that sense of desire.
And I think, you know, I lost my father about 4 years ago, and that was just a different experience for me. And I didn't realize how the two would be different. And, you know, I've been through grief before, but this is another level of grief. And I just, you know, the biggest reason why I called is because there's not many resources out there. You know, a lot of the stuff that I would see online is geared toward the traditional widower or widower. Mm-hmm. And the older crowd, you know, and I could relate to a lot of the things that I read online. I definitely related to a lot of them, but at the same time, you know, for a long time, partners have been passing and people have been living their lives well into 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s mm-hmm. with their partners. And I guess just because my loss was so sudden and I still young and so is he, that it's sort of, I feel like I'm on the fringe of something that I don't know how to, even with therapy, even with writing things out, even mm-hmm. with talking with friends. And sometimes I just, I don't know. When I don't know, that's when I have the impulses of just going on both apps and saying hi and try to spark conversations. And, you know, I'm out there again, and I accept that. And I also accept that. Yep.
And you're out there. Well, first of all, I wanted to say, you know, you say you don't necessarily feel comfortable in some of these spaces that are created for people who've lost their partners, because a lot of them are for straight people. And you don't have to be the tip of the spear, but most spaces for married people, most spaces for coupled people, weren't spaces where we were welcomed or really understood, spaces that felt inclusive to us until we burst into them, until we claimed space in them. And you may join a bereavement group for young people who've lost their partners, and they're out there, and be the only gay guy in the room and the first gay guy in the room. But you're not going to be the last gay guy in the room, and somebody has to be the first gay guy in the room. You don't have to be the tip of the spear. If you don't have that in you to be the first gay guy in the room, if you don't have to handle that at the same time that you're processing grief over the loss of your partner, don't guilt trip yourself about it. You don't have to. But we become present in those spaces when we enter them for the first time. That said, also, you're getting online. One of the things that happens to people who've lost their spouse is you move through spaces feeling like this object of pity, feeling like the widow or widower, and only that. And, you know, your friends are probably still a little intimidated by the depth of your grief. And there are going to be times where it's going to feel really good and life affirming for you to not be that first, to get online and have these flirty interactions where you aren't this ball of, you know, grief in the perception of the person that you're interacting with. When you're talking to your friends, I'm sure the first thing, the most present thing in their minds right now is, oh my God, he has suffered such a tremendous loss. And they handle you with kid gloves, and they handle you in this very respectful way. And they should, and that's what you need. But you also need the opposite. You need people that you interact with who that's not the most present thing in their minds when they're talking with you. Maybe what you need is some people to interact with who the most present thing in their mind when they're talking with you is they wonder what your dick looks like. Not because that's disrespectful to you or your partner, but because that's life and lust and love. And that's an energy that's within all of us. That's life affirming. To desire and be desired means to, you know, desire is about something happening in the future. And you had, and I'm so sorry, it's going to make me cry to talk about it. I can't imagine how you feel. The future you had with your partner got cut off. And that future that you imagined with him and you had with him is not to be. But what desire says is there's other futures that are possible for you. And you want to be able to tap into that.
Right.
And the memorial you build to your partner is not denying yourself a future. Or futures with other guys is not having other experiences and other contacts. The only caveat, the only thing I would say, and you should process this with your therapist. And I'm the one thing I am going to order you to do is talk to your therapist about this, about your conflicted feelings about the apps and your presence on them. You say you're going to a gay positive therapist to process your grief. Open up about this concern too. If it's not compulsive, if it's not self-negating, if after you have these interactions, you don't feel worse, then go for it. Then it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I've been on for about 5-6 months, and it's just a mixed bag of sometimes I feel better by myself because I have good interactions and conversations, and, you know, and that makes me feel good. And I'll have days, or it's been, you know, a few times where it's been weeks where I've had good interactions, and then it's a mixed bag with the rest of it.
A mixed bag because you encountered some shitty people, which we all encounter sometimes, or a mixed bag because you end up feeling like you're there for the wrong reason, whether you're encountering good or bad people. Which is it?
Probably about the same. I mean, don't get me wrong. I haven't been disrespected at all about that. And I usually try to save that little nugget of information until I get to know somebody a little more.
I didn't want to throw that out. I didn't mean when you roll out the information about being a recent widower. I meant when you say sometimes the interactions are bad, I just thought, you know, if what you're getting, you know, sometimes you go and you have good interactions and you feel good about yourself, you feel good about them. And so it feels like the right place to be. But sometimes you're going to get on an app or walk into a gay bar and have a bad interaction. It doesn't mean you shouldn't have gotten on the app or walked in the gay bar. It just means you didn't meet the right person that time. It doesn't mean you shouldn't have been there. It doesn't mean that impulse to go there was necessarily the wrong impulse or an impulse you shouldn't have acted on. Just like sometimes you go out and you meet jerks. Sometimes you go out and you meet somebody you needed to meet at that moment, whether it was for an evening, a weekend, a month, the rest of your life.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, it's a new normal for me. And every day it's a new process, a new normal. but I'm going day by day. And so, you know, it's little stuff like this, just reaching out guidance, I guess. And that's why I wanted to give you a call. I'm so glad you called me back.
Well, my heart goes out to you, and I'm glad we were able to get on the phone. And again, nothing about desire negates your feelings for your late partner or in any way undermines the profound nature of your grief. You can have both.
Okay. I'm learning that, yeah.
Yeah, and my heart goes out to you. My heart breaks for you. I'm so sorry.
All right. Well, thanks, Dan.
Hi, I'm a 32-year-old woman, and I've been with my spouse for 8 years, married for 6 of those. He's the only person that I've had sex with. I identify as somewhat asexual, but I definitely do feel a romantic and sexual attraction sometimes, such as for my husband, who I do love very much and whom I know loves me as well. But for about the past year, I've been wanting to test out some openness in our relationship, mainly around physical intimacy, just simple things like cuddling, physical closeness, maybe kissing. It's not about sex, and I think more about feeling open and connected to others. In fact, I don't want to have sex outside of my marriage. I think that my husband is a bit asexual too, and in some ways we're very compatible in that way and both happy with somewhat infrequent sex. I'm also the only person that he's ever had sex with. The point is, I'm a bit confused by these contradictory feelings of, on the one hand, feeling fairly asexual, but on the other hand, wanting to be physically close with multiple people. I'm afraid that if I raise the question of monogamishness, that he won't understand this paradox either. And I'm hoping that you might be able to shed some light on this and give me some understanding or insight that could be helpful as I get ready to have this conversation with my husband. I feel like this is hard to broach because if it's not about sex, it's going to be even harder for him to understand why I'd be looking for anything outside of our relationship. There's a confounding variable here too, or well, maybe an explanatory one, and that is that I struggle with depression, and for the past year, it's been worse than usual. My husband doesn't understand this side of me, but I've talked a lot to two other people who happen to be two male friends in particular about this, who understand depression and who I can be much more candid with about it and who have perspectives of their own to offer. These are in particular the two I'd like to be able to be physically close and comfortable with, especially as we discuss these sensitive things, and I know that they would like that too. In some ways, it would help ease and goes along with the emotional intimacy that's helping me get through this depressive episode. My husband knows that I've been talking with them about this, but I feel like having a conversation about some openness in our relationship would help ease my guilt about this and also give me the freedom to take honestly pretty PG physical comfort in these men. I would be willing to allow him the same, of course, but I don't honestly know if he would be interested. Anyway, am I being selfish here? What things should I think about as I think about this?
You're asexual, and your husband, you believe, is similarly situated, perhaps also asexual. Sex is infrequent and not an important part of your relationship and your connection. But intimacy is important. Cuddling, kissing, holding. You share these things with your husband, and presumably they are the most important form of intimacy that you share with your husband, because sex isn't that important to you, sex isn't that important to him, and this connection, the holding, the kissing, the cuddling, that physical closeness, that physical intimacy that many asexual people say that they desire in a relationship, that they want physical intimacy, they want comfort, they want a connection that is reinforced by that kind of physical intimacy and comfort, but they don't want sex. So for people who are sexual, people like me, for the text of at-risk youth, it can sound like what you want to ask your husband for is something trivial or trifling. You just want to cuddle with somebody else, just want to maybe kiss someone else. And that's small beans. Well, yeah, but it's not small beans if that is the most important form of intimacy that you share with your husband, if that is the foundational intimacy in your 8-year relationship. What you're asking from your husband is actually something large. You're asking for a big thing. You're asking to share with other men the kind of intimacy that you have up to now only shared with him. And you're not talking about sex. You're talking about the more important kind of intimacy for you: cuddling, kissing, holding. And you have this desire to do that with others. And maybe your husband would regard the request as trivial. Maybe he's more sexual than you are. But I doubt it, because it sounds like this is a very significant aspect of your intimacy, of your connection with your husband. Now, your question to me is, how do I roll this out? How do I unpack this? Not to yourself. It sounds like you have a pretty firm grasp of this. What you're asking me is, how do I unpack this to my husband so as not to upset or alarm him? And I don't have an answer there, because I can't predict how your husband will react to this request. It seems to me that you just have to speak your truth. You have to say what it is that you want and need right now, where you have this feeling, this desire to be intimate in this way, to be physically close in this way with other men at this moment, and that you don't have a full understanding of what it means. And maybe it's tied to your depression, but this is what you're feeling. And you should be able to share with your husband these thoughts, these impulses, these feelings. You should be able to unpack them with him and process them with him without a guaranteed answer, without knowing in advance how he's going to react, and without knowing in advance whether he's going to give you his consent. And it's a risky conversation. There's no way to avoid that. And it could be an intensely awkward conversation. And it could, for him, be a potentially hurtful conversation. But it sounds for you like this is a necessary conversation and a place you need to go, and a conversation that you need to have. And who knows, maybe having the conversation will result in you and your husband reconnecting in a way that leads to the evaporation of these feelings that leads to you not feeling this impulse or this strong desire to connect physically with other men. Maybe this is a desire to find outside your marriage what you're not getting inside your marriage right now. And that conversation will prompt your husband to step up or prompt you to look at each other through new eyes and re-cement your connection. And you may not feel as strongly about wanting to be physically intimate with others in this way after this conversation, though I doubt it. Sounds like you really do need this. And very often that is not the case, that having the conversation leads to the desire evaporating. But you can't have the conversation without risk. You can't have the conversation without potentially upsetting your husband. And I can't tell you how to feel about this or how to understand it. You say you don't fully understand these impulses and these feelings. The only way to come to a fuller understanding of your impulses and feelings is to think about them and talk about them, not with your friendly neighborhood faggot sex advice podcaster, but with your husband. And in the unpacking with him, not the unpacking with me, you will come to a deeper understanding of the significance and importance of this for you and how much you're willing to risk to have it in your life, this intimacy with us. And who knows, maybe it'll be a great big nothing burger. Maybe you'll go to your husband and say, would it be all right if when I have these conversations with my friends who understand depression because they've suffered it too, that we lay with each other, hold each other, and are intimate with each other, not sexual, no sex, just physical contact. And your husband might look at you and go, oh, that's no problem. Or he might look at you and have a lot of questions. He might look at you and feel insecure or jealous. But there's only one way to find out how he's going to react. And that's to go to him and to begin to unpack this, not with me again, but with him.
Hi, Dan. This is a young woman in Wisconsin calling to you with an etiquette question. Do I need someone's consent to give them sex advice which might make them uncomfortable? The story is I went on a date with this guy who seemed to be pretty great, not a misogynist, not stupid, didn't mansplain things to me. We had a really nice time, had shared interests, so I followed him back to his apartment and everything went downhill. My impression was that this guy was pretty inexperienced and his knowledge of sex had come from low-quality porn, which he was then trying to recreate with me. Since I had no interest in recreating low-quality porn with him, I hadn't texted since that night. And then a couple weeks ago, he texted me, trying to start something up, so I said to him, look, no, I'm glad you enjoyed that 30-minute hand job. I didn't actually say that. I said, I'm glad you enjoyed it and have a nice time. And could I give you some advice? And then silence. After the could I give you some advice text, I didn't hear anything from him for a week and a half. And then I sent him sort of a follow-up text. That, should I interpret your silence as you don't want to hear the advice? Or should I interpret your silence as you're waiting for me to say something? That was a few days ago now, and I still haven't heard from him. So part of me says, well, just let this go. Let there be another sexually inept man out there in the world, frustrating women like me. But then another part of me says, he's a good guy. I think he's actually a decent person. And if I phrase his advice in such a way that he could actually hear it, absorb it, and change his behavior, maybe he could be a GGG partner for somebody in the future.
He's obviously not interested in your critique of his performance. That doesn't mean he wouldn't benefit from it potentially. So maybe you should let it rip in that text and give him that download. You can sugarcoat it. You can, and it's not really sugarcoating. It's truth telling that you thought he was a decent guy and a nice guy and a good guy, but perhaps an inexperienced one based on what went down that night or what didn't go down that night. There are a lot of people out there who are inexperienced sexually, an experience with intimacy and partnered sex, but who've watched a lot of porn. Porn all too often is the default sex educator these days, and it can leave somebody with a repertoire of moves that can be off-putting because real sex and partnered sex ain't porn. I'm a big fan of MakeLoveNotPorn.com, Cindy Gallup's program, which is pro-sex, pro-porn, and pro-knowing the difference, and perhaps this guy doesn't know the difference. Maybe instead of the point-by-point critique of his performance, you could just send him the link to MakeLoveNotPorn.com. And he can, if he's so motivated, do a little reading and surfing around, and maybe that will inspire him to be introspective or not. He may not be receptive to what you have to say. You might not be the right messenger, But if you'll feel better to get it off your chest, I think when you've had sex with somebody and you have a feeling, you're allowed to share that feeling. And you two had sex and you had a feeling about it. And if there's something you need to say and you think it might benefit that person to hear it, you should go ahead and say it.
Hey, Dan, I'm calling in response to show 557, the very first call out of the shoot about the guy who wants to out the dude he's been screwing to his girlfriend. And I'm usually in agreement with your opinion and your comments, but I think you're way off on this one. I think the caller is as big of a scumbag as the other dude, and nothing good can come out of him outing this guy to his girlfriend. In fact, we're only hearing his side of the story. And he's a big enough scumbag, and who knows, he's telling the truth. I think the advice should be walk away. You learn something about yourself and leave everybody as is.
Hi, Dan. This is a message for the guy from episode 557 who was dating a guy from Grindr who was a closeted bisexual guy with a girlfriend. Normally, I would say, don't tell the girlfriend because it's none of your fucking business. But as a woman who dated a closeted bi guy for 5 years, who is a cheating piece of shit behind my back with guys, girls, groups, whoever, because he couldn't bear to tell me the truth or be out with his desires, you know, I paid the price for it. And he exposed me and many other people to all kinds of awesome diseases in the process. So, you know what? Go ahead and tell her, because I found out anyway, and so will she. I just wish I would have found out a hell of a lot sooner.
Hey, Dan. I'm calling in regards to a caller from show 557 about ghosting. Yeah, it really fucking sucks. And I think one of the best things that we can do in this age of dating with Tinder and all of that is to be someone who doesn't do that. So anytime that you've been on a date with somebody and it just hasn't gone well for whatever reason, just be honest. I think that's the best way to do it. And then hopefully they will learn from that. And then moving forward, they will be a more respectful person to the people that they don't care to see anymore.
And we're going to leave it there. 206-302-2064 is the number here at the Savage Lovecast. If you want to record a question or a comment for a future show, give us a buzz. 206-302-2064. Read my sex advice column, Savage Love, every week in the Georgia Strait and other newspapers all over the place. And if you like my political rants at the top of the show, you should check out Blabbermouth, The Stranger's other podcast. It's a political week in review podcast. You can find it on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Follow me on Twitter at @FakeDanSavage. Follow Mistress Matisse on Twitter at Mistress Matisse. And you can check out Velvet Swing Products at Velvet Swing. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian and me and the tech savvy at-risk youth. And Nancy, we'll all be back at you next week with another installment of the Savage Lovecast.